Now, from the global market to a very local and competitive market, the fight for parking spaces. Cities across the United States are updating the way they are managing on-street parking. Washington, D.C. is the front of this effort. Officials are working with private companies, and they are trying out on D.C. drivers no fewer than 5 different technologies to collect parking revenue. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin inspected some of the new gizmos.
Most of the meters in Washington are still the classic ones. You know, the ones on gray metal poles with coin slots and a window that tells you how much time you have left. They haven't changed much since they first came out in the 1930s. Newsreels like this one first introduced Americans to the newfangled technology.
In many cities throughout the country, the newest thing for downtown parking is the 5-cent parking machine.
The big difference now, of course, is that 5-cent parking machine now wants a lot more than 5 cents. Here in Washington, D.C., driver Paul Horton says it's gotten a little ridiculous.
Who walks around, if you really have some business to take care of, with $5 worth of quarters? You know, no one.
But change is in store. D.C.'s transportation director Gabe Klein is in charge of upgrading the city's parking services.
We're sort of at the forefront of a lot of this because we're testing so many different types of systems.
Here's one of them, a pay-by-phone system. You park in front of an old coin meter, but instead of putting in a bunch of coins, you call a phone number, then give your credit card number and the number on the parking spot that's on a sticker on the meter.
Your parking session has now started.
In D.C.'s U Street district, Pat Tompkins encounters another experiment in parking.
Give me a license plate.
She's clutching a zipper pouch of quarters and squinting at a shiny new kiosk with a whole keyboard of multicolored buttons. She needs to enter her license plate and the amount of time she wants to park. Traffic police can drive past, scan her plates, and know if she's paid or not.
I don't know my license plate. I mean, I have to get my wallet out and look at my registration.
That's just a little nuisance.
It took her a couple of tries, but she sorted it out. Down by the National Mall, Steve Spitzer watches his friend wrangle with another kind of kiosk. You enter the parking spot number and the amount of time you want to stay. You pay by cash or card.
I guess this is good. I mean, it's like 2010. You should be able to pay with a credit card.
Credit cards are accepted by all these new parking devices. No need for buckets of coins. Cards are convenient for drivers, and it makes it easier for cities to charge more. But they can't charge too much. Richard Little directs the Keston Institute for Infrastructure at the University of Southern California.
They will charge a rate that the market will bear, and when parking gets too expensive, people will stop using it or they'll stop driving.
Little says drivers will complain, but prices will be closer to what scarce city curb space is actually worth. Urban planning experts also say that higher prices can create a cascade of positive effects. People don't stay in spots as long, so more spots are open. Then there's less circling around. And that can mean less traffic, fewer accidents, less air pollution, and so on. Well, D.C.'s transportation director, Gabe Klein, is still working at the ground level. He's pointing to a baseball-sized black mound embedded in asphalt. It's in the middle of a parking spot. The mound has a sensor that knows if a car is parked there and can transmit that information wirelessly.
What we want to do is get to a point where you can look on your phone and see how many spaces are available on a block face and then go grab one of those spaces.
Klein fantasizes about a broader system where parking is connected to all transport options, from buses to bikes. Then people can look at all of those schedules and costs on their computer or mobile phone screens and make the most efficient choice. Okay, that's pretty cool. But first, they've got to get the technology right. And it's not going right at this new kiosk. At least 4 people have been fumbling with the various buttons and the steps. Some drove off defeated. But Andy Bricky, despite repeatedly inserting his credit card and getting error messages, decided to keep his car parked there anyway.
Well, we'll just see if I get a ticket today.
Clearly, there are bumps in the road before 21st century parking realizes its potential. Selena Simmons Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. We're going to look this morning at one of the bigger questions facing the country this fall. It's an economic question, and it has political implications. The question is why employers have not been hiring, even though the economy has been recovering. The unemployment rate rose to 9.6% last month. NPR's Jim Zaroli spoke with business owners in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Cherry Hill lies just across the Delaware River from Philadelphia, a busy bedroom community crisscrossed by traffic-clogged highways. It's probably best known as the site of a large shopping mall. Over the years, lots of office parks and small businesses have sprung up in Cherry Hill.
When I run it through the plotter, it may be offset just a tad. You know?
At Signorama, a small sign franchise in a strip mall on Route 70, a salesman is discussing a job with a designer. The company's owner, Chuck Eldridge, says business fell off a lot last year, but now he's got a contract at a nearby military base, and he's making signs for a town revitalization project.
We have a lot of unique opportunities that I feel confident we can sustain the business we're doing now, and it's not bad, it's just not as good as it was a couple years ago.
What Eldridge isn't doing is hiring anyone new. If he needs new workers, there are contractors he can call, and he keeps a business card on his desk for a temporary work agency if he ever needs it.
It's not frequent. I sometimes grab that going, you know what, I almost need it, but we end up not needing it.
It's a refrain you hear a lot in Cherry Hill. Although the economy has improved somewhat, businesses are still getting by without more workers. The unemployment rate in Camden County was 10.6% in June, above the national average. Howard Needleman is a real estate developer and property manager who employs about 20 people. He got through the downturn without laying anyone off, but he's not doing the big projects he used to do.
Where I may have been spending $2 or $3 million a year in redoing spaces or upgrading buildings, I'm not doing that now. So where one of my major contractors may have been employing 10 or 15 people, and then he had subcontractors out there, that no longer exists.
Needleman has had to lower rents, and like a lot of people in the real estate business, he's seen his occupancy rate fall. So he doesn't expect to do much hiring.
I think we're all sitting back and waiting to see if the people are interested in renting again, and I don't see that. We see that occupancy is going to continue to go down before it goes back up again.
Still, there are glimmers of hope. One of the town's biggest employers, a coffee company, is expanding, and a new hospital is being built. At Flying Fish Brewery, bottles travel down an assembly line to be cleaned and filled with beer. President Gene Muller says business was, well, flat for a while, but now he's hoping to expand.
We've been looking at that. Right now we are really tight for space. What we've been able to do is, in the interim, add some more part-timers. There's a lot of good folks out there now who've lost jobs, so we've been able to really, it's a pretty good pool of part-time folks. And
so what will it take to get you to make some of those new part-time people full-time?
Just to see that this good trend continues.
One thing that's holding him back is healthcare costs, which shot up 26% this year. And he doesn't think Washington is doing much to help businesses like his.
My confidence is kind of still a little shaky in that I want to see what happens with the elections. I think there's a lot of, you know, hand grenades or mud being thrown from side to side. And it's kind of like, that's not solving the problems.
Still, Mueller has managed to survive the big downturn, and like a lot of business owners in Cherry Hill, he thinks the worst is probably over. But that doesn't mean he's ready to start hiring anytime soon. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. No one's really sure how many Americans are Muslim. The estimates range anywhere from 1 to 7 million. But what's clear is that over the past few weeks and months, almost every poll that's been taken on Muslims has pointed to one conclusion. Anti-Islamic sentiment is on the rise. And the majority of Americans, including New Yorkers, oppose the construction of an Islamic cultural center near the former site of the World Trade Center. In towns across the country, the voices of those who don't want mosques built in their neighborhoods are growing louder.
We want America back. That's all we're asking for.
No more mosques.
No more.
No more mosques.
Perhaps most alarming is that in a country where religious tolerance is venerated, even held up as an example to a world where that isn't always the case, the level of hostility towards the idea of building a mosque in a specific location is so pronounced.
You know, Nazis don't have the right to put up a sign next to the Holocaust Museum in Washington. We would never accept the Japanese putting up a site next to Pearl Harbor.
Right.
There's no reason for us to accept a mosque next to the World Trade Center.
This is an insensitive move on the part of those Muslims who want to build that mosque in this location that feels like a stab in the heart of collectively Americans who still have that lingering pain from 9/11.
The voices of Newt Gingrich and Sarah Palin. In a few moments, we'll find out why Muslims in one grassroots movement have decided to remind their fellow Americans that, well, they're Americans too. But first, some voices from Muslims across the country.
My name is Fawad Shaikh, and I live in Los Angeles, California.
Barbara Kandaker, and I live in Cumming, Georgia.
My name is Zara Nasser, and I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Over the last few weeks, I've been unsettled by this rising tension or hostility towards Islam and Muslims in the U.S.
You feel a connection to the greater American community, and then when that community itself is saying, well, we don't really like you, you don't belong here, I think that it's both disheartening and a little frightening.
Previous to this, even after 9/11, there had been, a fair amount of anti-Muslim sentiment in the U.S., but it hadn't ever bothered me on a personal level.
My name is Hussein Nagamia. I have at no time since my immigration to the United States felt that I was unsafe in this country, until now and recently.
I am careful about who I talk to in public. Not so much just talking to them, but other Muslims that I greet, I don't automatically go say, hi, assalamu alaikum, because I don't want to draw attention to myself that I'm Muslim or that they're Muslim, just in case someone out there might be crazy.
You kind of feel afraid that everyone thinks that way. You know, everyone who's not Muslim believes that. That is probably the most frightening out of everything.
It always eventually passes. So in my mind, I have no doubt that eventually we will be accepted because we are American Muslims. But given all of the stuff that's going on, I have the feeling that it might take much, much longer.
Voices of a few American Muslims who spoke to us this past week. In his column today, New York Times writer Nicholas Kristof points out that in 1940, 17% of the population considered Jews to be a menace to America. Almost every ethnic group in this country has gone through a period of transition when they had to fight to prove that, indeed, they were Americans. Rabia Ahmed and a group of Muslim leaders thought their community had to do the same today. So this week, they launched an online video campaign called My Faith, My Voice. And the message is simple. Here's a clip.
I am an American.
I'm a Muslim.
This is my faith.
This is my voice.
Rabia Ahmed says they wanted to first address the fears of some people about the proposed Islamic Center in Manhattan.
Many of the arguments that are made in opposition to the mosque have to do with the fear that Muslims are trying to impose their faith on Americans, or are ignoring the sensitivities of Americans, or trying to build mosques all over and therefore, you know, trying to take over this country in some fashion. And we as a community, when we hear these things, we want to just reach out and say, look, if that's what you're worried about, then you don't have anything to worry about. That's not who we are, and that's not what we're about.
Rabia, how did it get to this point? You know, where in a sense you're stating what should be painfully obvious, that people who practice the Muslim faith in America are Americans just like anyone else.
You know, it is sad that it has to be said, but it's necessary nonetheless, because this rhetoric, these anti-Muslim feelings, they're not just coming from the usual right-wing or agenda-driven circles. Polls indicate that these fears are widespread. They're in the hearts of average Americans, moderate Americans. And that's what's so concerning about this. In the post-9/11 climate, there was anti-Muslim backlash, but it wasn't so open. It wasn't so hostile. It wasn't so widespread. And whatever the Muslim community has been doing the past 10 years, it's been a good effort, but for some reason, it's not achieving its goal.
Do you think, as a society, we're in the midst of maybe a passing storm, you know, something that we will look back on in 10 or 20 years from now and wonder how it ever came to this?
I hope so. I hope it is a passing storm. I hope that it's just a matter of time where Muslims are seen as part and parcel of the society. You know, if we look back at our history, other communities have faced this kind of discrimination or this kind of feelings, and they've been able to overcome, but it's not going to happen by itself. The Muslim community is going to really have to reach out in different ways, you know, through interfaith relations, through public service announcement, through whatever way that people can contribute and try to address these issues. Because if it's not done, then there's a potential of it just getting worse.
That's Rabia Ahmed. She's one of the people behind a new online video campaign called My Faith, My Voice. Rabia Ahmed, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Historian Edward Curtis has written a book called Muslims in America. He says Muslims have been in this country since the very beginning.
They were slaves. They were forced here as part of the Middle Passage. And perhaps as many as 20 or 30,000 were in the 13 colonies and in the United States until 1865. They came from West Africa, which had been undergoing a very gradual process of Islamization since the 11th century.
And where were those first mosques?
So these would have been informal places. One was in Kent Island, Maryland, where the first Muslim American celebrity of the 18th century was brought in 1730. His name was Job Ben Solomon. He later went on to co-author a very important African-American slave memoir, was taken to England. Oglethorpe, the founder of Georgia, bought his bond, and he was sent back to West Africa to be a financial representative for economic interests from Britain.
But it wasn't until 1921 that the first purpose-built mosque came about that was in Detroit. Why did it take so long?
The number of practicing Muslims faded among African Americans by the late 1800s. There's no evidence, with just one or two exceptions, that Muslims passed on their religious traditions to their children. African American slaves tended to practice West African traditional religions or Christianity in the 19th century. But as that population of Muslims was declining, the population of Muslims from the Middle East and Southeastern Europe was increasing. Immigrants came from Turkey, from Syria, and today the countries all Palestine, Jordan, Israel, seeking opportunity like the Southern Italians and the Greeks of the same era. And they were the ones who first began to pray together, probably as early as the 1880s or 1890s, but we just haven't found any archaeological or documentary evidence that would establish for us that there was an actual gathering of prayer at some sort of mosque space.
Now, today, I think most Americans would be surprised to learn something that you've written about. You write a lot about the myths of Islam in America, that far and away, the single largest Muslim ethnic group in America are African Americans, not Arab Americans, not South Asians.
Yeah, and of course, that goes back to decades, almost 100 years now. The first African American indigenous groups of Muslims who were not slaves, they began in the 1920s, even before W.D. Farad Muhammad established the Nation of Islam, which was later taken over by Elijah Muhammad. In the 1920s, we already had several different groups of African American Muslims practicing what is often referred to as Orthodox Islam, well before World War II.
Edward Curtis, based on your research, can you assess what the kind of the mainstream American perspective was on Muslims throughout most of American history? I mean, how did Americans see Muslims?
Muslims have been important players in the American national consciousness since the days of the Puritan. Cotton Mather thought that Muslims were a sign of a Christian schism. That kind of misunderstanding or negative view of Islam has been with us always, and it's kind of come and gone in cycles.
When did we first sort of start to see really pronounced anti-Muslim sentiment in America? I mean, is what we're seeing today pretty new?
Well, it's really hard to compete with Cotton Mather and some of the Protestant evangelicals of the 1820s and 30s who go on and on about Muhammad and Muhammadans or Muslims being the Antichrist. So in terms of that viciousness, I don't think, you know, that it's gotten any worse since then. But I would say that until there was a significant population of Muslims here, then sometimes that kind of prejudice didn't lead into discrimination and hate crimes until really pretty recently.
That's Edward Curtis. He's a religious studies professor at Indiana University, Purdue University in Indianapolis, and the author of the book Muslims in America, A Short History. Edward Curtis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.